of social value and also for constructing social difference. The two-table pattern, as Elvin Hatch has called the separate eating arrangements for workers and family in households, was a symbolic marker of social distance. Employers ate only with people they considered the social equals in the dining room, while servants ate in the kitchen. The meaningful practices and perceptions generated by the class habitus can be illustrated in Galini's willing self-exclusion from things from which she was already excluded, that is, access to her lawyer's goods. I quote, "After 2 days, he waited for his children to come from America, and they cooked and slaughtered the kitchen. They were wealthy people, yes, and they said, 'Oh gosh, the food is not enough. We have to make something more.' And I interrupted and said, 'I don't mind if I don't eat.' This stayed with them until they died, because I said, 'I don't mind not to eat,' as if my portion would be enough for the rest." Bourgeois domestic space was created through the demarcation of space. Space is one of the sites where power is asserted and exercised, and no doubt in the subtlest form as symbolic violence, using Bourdieu here. This demarcation shaped mid-class identity, which was based in upper-class households on the elimination of labor and on the possession of servants. In the interwar period, not only the management and control of servants, but also mistresses' labor was part of the middle-class identity. The decline of living domestic service in the interwar period and the shift to day work might have been the reason behind the propagation of mistresses' domestic labor. In fact, in middle and lower middle-class households, this has always been the case. The mark of respectability was the containment of this labor inside the house. Shopping and washing, as well as sweeping and cleaning the outside of the house, was a clear mark of vulgar labor. Housewifery schools since the late 19th century were mainly addressed to middle-class women, although domestic servants might have followed these classes. Although the aim of these schools was the introduction of middle-class women to the management of the household and of servants, as well as of the family budget, there was always a hope that knowledge in housewifery would eliminate the need of servants, or at least servants' mismanagement of household property, in the same way as good mothering would eliminate the disastrous effects of gouvernante on the bringing up of children. The new domestic electric appliances were celebrating as relieving mistresses from household conflict produced by servants, promising a future without servants. And I quote, "It is true that no American woman has domestic servants in her house, but does all the chores herself. But it is easy for everybody to purchase all these machines with a system of monthly installments, which is widespread in the United States." End of quote. The true story of a middle-class mistress who found the ideal servant reveals not only what the requirements were from a servant, but also the naturalization of class distinction. The mistress was without a servant, and I quote, "this necessary and valuable misfortune for 10 days. A friend of hers recommended a girl, cousin of her servant, from the island. Both looked pretty and honest. And I quote, she was a pretty, full of health, blonde islander, with a proud body and a good chaplet of thick plaits in her head. I liked from the first sight her modest look, the cheap, sparkling dress, her thick socks and insular slippers." End of quote. As she did not know how to do the chores, she refused the salary until she learned the housekeeping. However, she had notified her mistress in advance that she would not stay permanently. In a week, Maria became the perfect servant. I quote, "she was disciplined, she was respectful, but without being servile, invisible, but always present, stealthy like a shadow, but worth for 10. At the time she stayed in my house, she did not even get close to the window, and the only person she ever talked was her cousin." End of quote. finally, it turned out that both servants were two very rich women from the countryside. One of them fell in love with a gentleman, and she would marry him until she was sure that she could be a lady. For that reason, she traveled to Athens to become a servant in order to see how a lady is and whether she too could become a lady. Maria had simply accompanied her in Athens. Read in conjunction with other forms of discursive evidence, the above story can be used to investigate how thinking around a pivotal issue was organized. As late as 1940, it appeared as if the debates on labor legislation had never existed. The above narrative brings us back to dominant 19th century perceptions about domestic service as a private issue allocated to the mistress and to its crude personalization. Through the ruralization of the issue, an idealized image of the past transported to the present signified the lacks and impossibilities of the present. The demands of mistresses and the qualities of servants expressed through endeavors like the asylum of St. Catherine acquired here their full arrogance. The mistress and her friend did not meet the perfect servant. These do not exist according to the narrative because they were not finally true servants. They were wealthy rural women whose richness was not the immoralizing wealth of the urban bourgeoisie, but consisted of vineyards, plots, cutlery, houses, and servants. She would, a quote, become a doula, a derogatory term that means slave, in order to learn manners from a lady and to become a lady, end of quote. This idealized depiction is darted to the future, a future in which not an ordinary lady, but a truly Greek female physiognomy would be born out of the marriage of tradition with modernity and probably free from the need of servants. The gender space of the house was not immune from class conflict. Through the attempts of middle-class females and their associations to take possession and regulate the private sphere and its underlying relationship, the private was brought in the most dynamic way to the public. The localization of class conflict in the mistress-servant relationship was not produced through the gender division of roles with middle-class women, which middle-class women promoted since the late 19th century. The similarities of roles fulfilled by an unpaid servant, mistress, and a paid one was dealt through technologies employed by mistresses to produce difference, and through difference, the class subjectivities. Thank you.
Thank you, Pothiti. You were very precise. I directly turn to Sophie Day. Is the same title, or you want to?
No, it's fine. The house
Sex Work and the Vanishing Housework.
Sex Work and the Vanishing Household was my original title, and it's still my title. However, the paper that went with the title I put to one side because it's very nice to be here, and I'd like to thank you for inviting me, and also to say there have been so many, I've learned so much today and yesterday, and so many themes have come up. That I felt to introduce too many more themes wasn't terribly helpful at this late stage of the day, so I'm going to do something a little different. And as it's kind of in my head rather than on paper, you just have to interrupt me if it doesn't make sense or if it's too abstract. And I will talk about sex work, and I will talk about the vanishing household, but they'll kind of come through a slightly different narrative than they might have done. So thank you, and I would begin by speaking a little bit to themes that have come through many papers about changes in the division of labour over a variable amount of time, where we are talking in some general way about the penetration of capital into areas of life that were previously considered outside the productive system. some people might take this back to industrialization, some people might decide rather to do a post-Keynesian trajectory, and other people still might choose a more recent penetration of capital into the body. But I think they can all be linked in different trajectories. So we're talking with the references to, especially the references we've had to global care chains and the pricing of affect and the commercialization of feeling, or the managed hand and the managed heart and so on and so forth. We're talking of one aspect of this penetration of capital into areas that were apparently not previously commercialized. But this goes alongside the penetration of capital into an ever more minute division of labor, if you like. So we can talk of new kinds of jobs that can be priced, and we can talk of new sorts of bodily productions that can be priced, so that we have a whole literature on the industrialization of life itself as the major shift in the last half of the 20th century, where you can buy, well, it was long before the last half of the 20th century that you could buy blood, but eggs and, what's more recent, DNA, I suppose. And so I thought maybe if I could situate what I'm saying within that kind of a trajectory, I could tie together some of the dualisms that we've heard of, where what it is that's priced or paid is talked about in relation to something that either shouldn't be priced and paid, or which remains unpriced or priceless. And I suppose the way that I was thinking about this was more to do with another series of references that came out today and yesterday, although it seems like several more days, of more recent changes where do we date it? The 1970s, perhaps, since the kind of Keynesian economy stopped. And I kind of wanted to anchor myself in discussions of the time in the 1970s, as, in a sense, the Keynesian consensus disappeared. Because at that time it was possible to talk about a realm of production and a realm of reproduction in association with relatively accepted and general frameworks in the division of labour and different parts of life. So, for example, in the British case, earlier in the 20th century, actually, there was this notion of a family wage. So you would have a head of household, normally a man, who would have the wage, which, in theory, reproduced the household. And you could talk about this as a direct wage relationship. But it was always a fantasy. It never existed, because lots of other people in the household, actually, across many classes, fraction, also had to work. But at the time in the 1970s, particularly in a feminist discussion of labour, many of these wages were not talked of as direct wages, but as indirect wages. All right, so you paid your male household head an apparent family wage, which was by no means sufficient to reproduce the household. So other members of the household, stereotypically women, sold what were then called personal services, and what we are calling here domestic labour, for which they received an indirect wage. Their employer, their apparent employer, wasn't their employer. He was the mediating figure between the capital class, if you like, and the labouring class. So were we in the 1970s to be talking about cleaning, caring, care of the elderly, and many other kinds of domestic work, we might talk about these in a very different way than we would have talked about working in a factory or whatever. So there was this contrast that people worked with between a direct wage and an indirect wage, which collapsed in the 1970s. And is very often talked about along terms of here we've talked about informalization, in other contexts we might talk about it in terms of neoliberalism. But where virtually all these kinds of distinctions between great domains of life, the great structures of the 20th century, are collapsed to internal divisions within the person. So virtually everybody now, male or female, will be carrying out productive work, reproductive work for a direct wage, for an indirect wage. And so I wondered if I could talk to some of the themes we've been discussing here in terms of how this plays out within the person and whether indeed it can play out within the person, because I think, I hope I'm not the only person who thinks that that's one of the themes that's actually we've been talking about for some time. So with this expansion of capital relations, the kinds of contrasts that we've been talking about are played out within the person. And here's the second point that I promise I won't talk about very much, but I do just want to make a comment about. We're talking about certain kinds of labour which are, in some contexts, productive, alienable labour for a wage or a price. But in another context, in a different place or with different people, will be counted as priceless reproductive work. These are carried out by the same person, often in the same relationships, in the same place. But I don't think we can theorize these without talking about sexual labor. So we've talked about certain aspects of affect, of heavy manual work, of bodily relationship. And it just was striking to me that in all of those discussions, nobody mentioned the word sex, I think I'm right in saying. And so a number of the distinctions we've been making between labour that you can get a wage for, between work that is reproductive, and between all sorts of other domestic labour or even extra domestic labour that can be sexualised, I think has to be brought back into the discussion here. And I don't think I'll do that now, because I think it just takes the theme off into too many places, but I will talk about it in relation to sex work. But you have to bear in mind, which may be complicated, because in English it's complicated, so if you talk about it to non-English speakers, I just have to say very, very clearly what sex workers I've worked with are doing. So I need to shift terrain now and talk, I'm not really talking about a theory of sexual labour, I'm talking about sex workers' own theories of labour, and I'm going to illustrate how these kinds of distinctions are played out within a single person or an apparently single body. So I worked initially with sex workers quite a long time ago in London, and then I ended up doing a study where I followed them and their careers and lives over a period of about 15 years, mostly prospectively, but obviously going backwards too. And I won't give you very many details, but I do want you to understand that the distinctions that sex workers make are important to all these other debates we're having about labour, which is what they're doing is either work or it's not work. It is completely irrelevant what that work consists of and where it takes place and who it takes place with. And normally speaking, English sex workers, well, actually non-English sex workers too, will make a distinction where the sex is the is the priceless bit, and the work is the priced bit. So they say you're either doing sex, which means you're not getting paid, or you're doing work for which you are getting paid. And that is the only distinction that counts. It doesn't matter where it is, whether it's in the house or somewhere else, and it doesn't matter who is. I think actually I just make a tiny detour into talk of the politics around this platform, because it's been very important in political platforms that sex workers have constructed over the last 40 years or so. Having said I won't talk about sexuality, I'll just do one little tiny detour. In the 1970s, there was quite a broad platform within feminist accounts of labour which said all female labour, all female work can be counted as labour. In other words, it can be abstracted in some sense, disembedded in some sense from the context in which it occurs, so as to be able to give it to quantify it and compare it with other kinds of labour.